Good afternoon, friends. I'm an alcoholic, a member of the Bowls Over Pine group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Jim. You know, the panel or the theme for this panel is a vision for you. And I was thinking when I was asked to do it, you know, that what more appropriate theme for a panel in Alcoholics Anonymous than one like that? You know, I know because at the end of my drinking, there weren't too many visions of my life. And the ones over there weren't really that good, you know. And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Fellowship, you know, the visions are positive now. And I've actually got some purpose to my life. And it all comes back to the program and fellowship. I was sitting back there watching the last speakers, you know, and looking at this coat of arms above my head. And I don't know how many of you are Canadian, but there's a coat of arms similar to that behind the judge in a courtroom, you know. And I'm sitting back there thinking, by the grace of God, you know. At every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we open with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. If you're new or fairly new to the fellowship, you know, maybe you could just take a moment to think of why you're here and what brought you here. And if you've been around for a while, maybe you know somebody that's hurting and could use a little prayer. Could we have that moment now, please? And the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I would like to introduce our first speaker. He will speak for 20 minutes. His name is Brian M., and he comes from Cumberlough, Scotland.
Hi there. My name is Brian, and I'm an alcoholic. They say I come from a place called Cumbernauld, just outside Glasgow. And we're very fortunate in the Glasgow area, because Glasgow and the surrounding area, the immediate surrounding area, we have in the regions of maybe 500 meetings on a weekly basis that we can attend, so we're very fortunate in that respect. The part that I've been asked to share on today, a vision for you from chapter 11 of the big book, the first part basically speaks about normal drinkers. And we've all seen the normal drinker, you know, the one that sits there with a beer that lasts all night. You know, and they go to the liquor store and they pick up a six-pack. You know, you've been standing there for half an hour in this queue. And I generally went, when I went to get my equipment, if you like, for the week, I mean, I took a mule pack with me, you know, and it was like an expedition, you know, more than anything else. I basically kind of sneaked in there. I was on a mission and started away. You know, you're quite well aware of how you start away with just, I'll get maybe a dozen beers, and then you think about, now, would a dozen be enough? Would I reach oblivion with a dozen beers? Probably not. So I better get two packs. And then we've got to consider the spirits as well. And probably the worst thing that ever happened to me was when I went on to the Atkins diet. And it was explained to me that red wine was actually very, very good for me. It's the worst thing. I could see my poor wife cringing, you know, when she was told that this was very beneficial to me. And as was the way, when, you know, on the way home, I would normally drop into the liquor store or the supermarket, and I would have my glasses perched just on the end of my nose, you know, and I would pick up the bottle of wine and have a look. And anyone looking would have thought it was some kind of connoisseur of red wines. And I would actually just keep turning the bottle round until I got to the percentage volume. And basically, if it never reached 14, you know, I would carefully put it back, you know, and sort of tut, you know. And that was basically the way it was for me. As I say, I drank for about 40 years before I was fortunate enough to find the doors of AA. I won't say that I was born an alcoholic, but I do believe that I was born poor in spirit. When I took my first drink at the age of 15, I think then I was an alcoholic. I don't think I ever became more alcoholic. I certainly got sicker, I got more sick, but I don't think I ever became more alcoholic. And I think that the progression of my illness, it went a long way. It stretched from, I was about 21 when I went to South Africa. I was so discontented and dissatisfied with what I had that I convinced my first wife, my third wife will be cringing sitting in the seat there, I convinced my first wife that we should actually go and seek our fortune in South Africa. And unfortunately, when I went there, my wages, my pay was quadrupled. And the price of booze was about a third what it was in the UK at that time. So it was absolutely fantastic. You know, I found myself in paradise. You didn't ask, there were no measures or anything. You just said brandy, you know, pour brandy. And the guy just poured brandy, you know. It was absolutely fantastic. But that was only to last about 3 years. And I came back and the illness really progressed. I was really fit then, you know. I mean, I boxed quite a bit, you know. I played football, ran marathons, that type of thing. But unfortunately, when I was running marathons, the illness had really kind of gotten a hold of me by then. And as you will be aware, I'm quite sure, the alcoholics amongst us, one of the side effects of alcoholism is severe diarrhea. And if you try and run 20 miles when you're suffering from severe diarrhea, it's very, very difficult. And health-wise, you know, my health was really suffering, and I'd gone to the doctor. I was complaining about pains in the stomach and this, that, and the other, you know. And the doctor actually asked me, he said, "Brian, do you have any diarrhea?" And I said, "Yes, doctor, how much would you like?" I've actually got tons of it, you know. I could really have been the first exporter of diarrhea from Scotland. But what I didn't understand, and I never really understood it until I came through the doors of AA, was that although in the early parts of my drinking, I was the life and soul of the party. You know, I played guitar and I sang and I told jokes all night and stuff like that. And the progression of the illness was such that initially, as I say, I would joke and laugh and sing all night. And then these periods got shorter where I would actually go into moods, you know, halfway through the night. And I would look about the people in the party, you know, people I didn't like. And things like that, and it just basically got that I wanted to be alone. I didn't want any company whatsoever. Pub drinking, I would actually go to the pub, and I would find a darkened corner and just sit alone, and I would hold up a paper in front of me just to bar anyone from actually coming to me and speaking to me. And if anyone come into the bar, then the paranoia would take over, the severe paranoia, because I would look at these people. If there was two walked in, I would say, they're definitely speaking about me. There's no doubt about it. You know, their mouths were moving, so they must have been speaking about me, you know. And this severe paranoia was really something else. So I became, basically, I drank in my car. I would find a lay-by, or I think they call it a rest area in Canada, you know, off the motorway. As I say, the pubs, I would find a lonely corner, or I would drink in the house. And my wife, I'm sure she won't mind me saying my third wife, because my life was a bit unmanageable. Marie's a nurse, and she would go night shift, and she spent 12-hour night shifts And I loved these 12-hour night shifts, because when Marie was night shift, I would prepare my evening. And the evening would start away, you know, when we're leaving work. And I would call in at the pub on the way home and regale all my friends with my razor-sharp wit. And obviously, if there were any world problems, you know, politics or who shot Cock Robin or something, then basically I would sort it out, you know. And I would leave them in no dubiety as to just who the man was. I would then get home. I would chew a lot of chewing gum and suck a lot of mints and stuff like that. And actually, kid myself on that my wife had no idea that I actually drank. You know, I'd walk into the cheery face, well, the big red face, and tell her what a wonderful day I'd had at work and how everything was fine, you know. And when it was time for Marie to leave for work, you know, then I would cheerily, you know, wave her goodbye and have a good shift, darling. I'll see you in the morning. Don't work too hard. I had already prepared for the evening. As I said, I would go in and buy this nice bottle of wine because I was just going to settle back. I was going to enjoy a couple of drinks. I wasn't going to go too far. I was just going to enjoy a couple of drinks. But the alcoholic mind was such that I couldn't just buy a bottle of wine. I had to buy maybe a bottle of vodka as a backup, just in case. And then you would say, well, really, is a bottle of vodka enough? If I bought a litre of vodka, then that would maybe do me two nights, you know. So I would buy maybe, you know, this litre of vodka and a nice bottle of wine. I mean, I've bought wine, honestly. Some of it's tasted like camel's urine, and that's putting it mildly. But never once, even with these bottles of camel's urine, never once did I put the bottle down. I always finished it. It was always a matter of, God, I hope I finish this very quickly, you know, because it tastes absolutely terrible, you know. But I never, ever gave it away. I poured it down the sink, yeah. So, as I say, I would wave my wife goodbye, and I would settle down in front of the television and pour myself a nice glass of wine. And then I would begin to think to myself just what a wonderful guy I was. How many other guys, when their wives had gone night shift, would actually sit at home and just sit happily watching the television? And that was fantastic, you know, and I would do that. I'd have one glass and I was just a nice guy. And then when I got into maybe glass two and three, I would then think how extremely lucky she was to actually have me, you know. She was just a very, very fortunate person. And once, you know, as I was getting down the wine bottle, I would think to myself, no, really, I mean, she's bitching a bit at me. Should I actually stay here or should I actually spread myself? Because, you know, other people should have a bit of me as well. As I say, I'd actually been married three times and engaged about three or four times, so I'd spread myself about quite a lot. But then, you know, once the wine was finished, this guy that was only going to sit down and have a couple of drinks, I would then open the vodka, and I would start sitting away until just total oblivion. And for everyone here, every alcoholic, I would waken up about 2 or 3 in the morning. Why was it always 2 or 3? It was like an alarm clock. It was always 2 or 3. It was never 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. It was always 2 or 3 o'clock. And I would waken up. I'd invariably spilt the booze over whatever I was wearing. I would lie and wonder for the first 4 or 5 minutes where I actually was, you know. I had no idea where I was, you know. I would start looking about and stuff. And then I would get up, and I don't know why alcoholics always head for the mirror. They always want to look at themselves and see how bad they actually are. I don't know why. So I would get up, you know, and my shorts would be, they'd be halfway, you know, shorts kind of hanging down and stuff. And as I say, my top was just full of booze and stuff like that. And I would go up and look in the mirror, you know, and I'd look and I'd say, oh, Jesus, I've been turned into a prune. You know, because I just see this big red face, you know, wrinkly and stuff like that. And if I opened my eyes, it was like Superman, you know, the big red eyes type thing coming out. Just absolutely terrible. And then I would have, what they talk about in chapter 11, you know, the four hideous horsemen, you know, they would come in, they would ride into the living room, as it were. And the four horsemen, they talk about terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And the terror for me was actually trying to figure out, what have I done? Who have I offended? Have I picked the phone up? Have I smashed anything in the house? Where have I hidden my booze? You know, because I would do that in a blackout. I would hide my booze somewhere and then spend, you know, especially at that time in the morning, I would spend many hours, many happy hours, you know, with the find the booze game, you know. And sometimes I never found it. Sometimes my wife would find it. In fact, there are areas of the house I haven't been in for a while, and I'm quite sure I've still got booze to find, to be quite honest. So that was the kind of terror part for me. The bewilderment was actually trying to figure out, how did it happen again? I was only going to sit down and have a couple of drinks. That was my intention. I just wanted to enjoy a drink, nothing else. I didn't want to harm anyone. So between the bewilderment and the frustration, you know, I just no idea how it had actually happened again. And then that despair would come in, you know. I mean, you know, the frustration part, I would say, well, I'm not a stupid guy. And I'm going to sort it out because it won't happen again. It will never happen to me again. I'll change it. I'll drink Guinness or something like that. You know, it's really healthy for you, you know, more so than a red wine. But then the despair part, where I actually knew that, no, it wouldn't change. It wouldn't be different. It would always be the same. I'd reached that jumping off point that they talk about. Health-wise, as I say, I'd been in hospital three times with pancreatitis. And pancreatitis, the consultant had said to me, the first time that I'd gone into hospital, take another drink, Brian, or you could die. But that was a fair enough price. That was okay. You know, I was just dying, like, because I didn't really care anyway. The second time, he kind of walked past my bed a bit quicker, you know, and just said, you could die, you know. And the third time, I think he shouted it from the end of the ward, you know, he was just, you could die, eh? I think these guys felt the frustration as well. So the only thing that I had to look forward to, basically, was death or a wet brain, you know. And that was the choice, nothing else. And in many instances, you know, death is more welcome than actually having a wet brain, eh? But then I found out about this. Some of you may have listened to Benny earlier on. Benny is my brother-in-law. And Benny has had a few years in the fellowship. And I'd been in Canada a few times and actually gone to meetings, you know, with Benny to listen to him speak and stuff. Well, my wife dragged me along. I didn't want to go, but I was dragged along. Because, I mean, let's face it, when you're a drinker, the last place you want to be is at an AA meeting, you know. You just don't want to be there. I mean, because there's too many truths come out. There's too many things, you know, people say things and there's little bits come up in your mind and you say, no, get off, I was, you know, no way, I'm not like that at all, but you know you are. So actually, Bernard was actually on holiday over in Scotland, and I had one particularly bad experience with drinking, where I made a complete fool of myself. We had a barbecue and we had friends over and stuff, you know. And I made a complete fool of myself. And I approached Bernard And I said to him, look, something's got to go here, you know, I've sort of reached the end of the road. And Bernard said, well, look, Brian, you're pretty drunk. Why don't you, if you're sober tomorrow, come and speak to me tomorrow. And if you're still like-minded, then we'll go to a meeting. So that's what I did. The following day, I went to Bernard. I said, nah, something's got to give here. I've got to go. And I can remember going to my first meeting. The only thing I remember about the first meeting was a guy saying to me, you need never drink again. And that was the diarrhea bite, you know, because what a fright I got. It was really a guy telling me I need never drink again. I drank for 40 years. You know, that was sacrilege stuff. You know, I attended that meeting, and that's all I remember about that particular one. But I took hope from that. But being such a sick individual, as I say, I drank for 40 years, being such a sick individual, I started going to meetings and I was still drinking. What I would do is leave my poor wife at night, you know, I would say to Marie, well, bye, I'm going to another meeting. I would then shoot out the driveway and go straight to the liquor store and buy a bottle of vodka. And for every meeting that I went to, I had a place that I would go and drink about half a bottle of vodka before I went to the meeting. And then I would sit in the meeting and lie as I had done for 40 years and say, yeah, my name's Brian, I'm glad to be here and I'm glad to be sober. No chance. I was sitting there half gargled, you know. I was half gassed. I would then leave the meeting and on the way home drink the other half bottle, and I would get in and my poor wife would say, well, how was the meeting? It was absolutely fantastic. It was brilliant. Would you like a wee song? You know, type thing. But I don't know what happened. I found myself in a lay-by not far from where I stay one night. In Scotland, they talk about the most important part of your body is your butt, if you'll excuse me, because as long as you keep taking your butt along to the meeting, eventually your brain will follow. And that's what happened to me. I just kept going to meetings. As I say, my last drink was in this lay-by, where I sat there with an absolutely giant bottle of cider. This bottle was so giant that I had to actually wind the window down to get the end of the bottle out the car, you know, so that I could lift it up and have a drink of it. It was absolutely giant. It was one of these where you got about 150% free or something, you know. But I can remember that actual, when I was drinking out of that bottle, I fully understood the pain that I was going to feel, because my throat was very badly burned. My stomach was in such a state, I couldn't eat, so the 18 days were past. And I knew that as soon as that cider slipped down my throat, that I was going to feel this excruciating pain when it hit my stomach. But I couldn't stop drinking it. And I kept taking this stuff. And the tears were running down my eyes as I was actually drinking it. And that's when I decided, no, I can't take any more. I'll give this AA a chance. And what a life I have now is absolutely fantastic. I'm 56 years of age. I know that will come as a hell of a shock to most of you. Because there's obviously I don't look that. But I'm in fact 56 years of age. I kind of lost my sight here. Where was I now? 56. I drank for that 40 years, and I knew that it wasn't only my drinking that had to stop, but my way of life had to stop. I couldn't continue the way I was. I knew that. But the life that I have now within the doors of AA are absolutely fantastic. Everything was suggested to me when I came in the doors of AA. And it was as well because I'm such a rebel. Had anyone told me to do anything, I could have caused an awful lot of, you know, an awful lot of trouble. But it was suggested to me, and that's okay to me. No one pressed the big book into me as soon as I walked in the door because, again, I was in no condition to read a big book. I was in no condition to read a comic, never mind a big book. So it was left until I actually recovered sufficiently. And then I got the big book. Of course, I wanted to rearrange the paragraphs and stuff like that, and I thought the steps were in the wrong order, and we could maybe add one here and take one away, but I eventually realised that it's worked for all these years. So it was going to work for a few more. So my life today is just unbelievable, and I have been given everything that was promised to me when I came in the doors of AA. But I didn't understand until I came in the loneliness that I actually felt. And the loneliness explained so much to me. It explained why I didn't care about family and friends. I had no interest. It's why, when I was in a happy relationship, I would just wave goodbye and go and find something else. It's why I was never, ever content in a job. And when I think I was promised unconditional love within the rooms of AA, and I've never had unconditional love, because even when I was a kid, when I was a child, as long as I made my bed, as long as I done well at examinations and stuff like that, then, it will love you. But if you don't do so well, then, we'll kind of shun you a bit. But in the rooms of AA, I found unconditional love. And that was fantastic. So I'm going to just finish off with a proverb which I heard from a gentleman called Kalidasa, who was a 4th century AD poet and playwright. And for me, it's the way I work my AA. And basically what he said was, yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, will make every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thanks, Brian. I'd like to, before I introduce our next speaker, we had Benny in the last panel, who's Scottish, and we've had Brian now, who's Scottish. Before I introduce Brendan, I just want you to know that we haven't let the United Kingdom take over the AA, because when you hear Brendan, you'll understand why. I'd like to introduce Brendan M. from Hastings, Ontario.
Hi everyone, my name is Brendan, I'm an alcoholic. Nervous alcoholic, but thanks very much for asking me to be here. They say you got to be a liar to qualify in this program. I'm a liar, a cheat and a thief, but I'll try and tell you the truth as best as possible. I'm a work in progress, so bear with me. I'm also a member of the CIA, that's the Catholic Irish Alcoholics. And I am a Canadian citizen now. Happy Canada Day to one and all. And Ireland is not in the United Kingdom. I'm asked to speak about a vision for you. I'll give you three. One is what I got from Bills, lying in a hospital dying. I got no trouble identifying with that. That's where I was on my way to. But I'd go out in my car outside, I'd be shaking, I'd be saying, Jesus Christ, something awful's going to happen. And something awful was going to happen, because I did not know how to stop drinking. And I'd lots of willpower, and I applied it to lots of other things, but it got me nowhere with the booze. Obviously, I wouldn't be here if I could. And Uncle Bill and Bob got together. That's the story for me and for you guys. It was tough luck. We're going to die. What did they say? We got locked up, we die, and we recover. But there was no recovery. The other story I'll give you is my sponsor story. This man, I heard him speak just after I came into AA, and he told me he'd been sober for 10 years, and he was in worse shape than he'd ever been when he was drinking. By which he meant he hadn't had a drink for 10 years. And that made the hair stand up in the back of my neck. Why? Because this selfish, recovering alcoholic didn't want it to happen to him. And Pat went on to tell me it was because he never worked the steps. He stopped drinking, all right, but then he wanted to get financially successful and put a whole bunch of other things before recovery. So there he was, 10 years without a drink and feeling worse and in more trouble than he'd ever been when he was drinking. And then there's the story that's in chapter 11 of the big book. You know, it is a vision for you. And Bill was back to talking. I know in the story of it, it should be a vision for us, I suppose. It's an inclusive thing. But he was back to that language, a vision for you, telling us what to do. And what he tells us in that chapter, and I include myself in it, is service. The whole chapter is about service. It says you want contented sobriety, well, you got to go and earn it. And that's what the 12 steps tell me. I can stop drinking. It's only mentioned in the first step, the booze. The other 11 are how to live my life to get contented sobriety. And for me, the price of contented sobriety is service. And it happens in AA and it happens outside AA. I believe, I'll tell you a little bit about myself to identify, but I really said all I need to say so far. I was born in Ireland. I'm the middle of 7 kids. My parents weren't alcoholic, but the society I grew up in was. And from the youngest age, I can remember the feeling that I didn't fit in. My parents were a bit unusual in that they had the first kid when they were 35 and the seventh when they were 45. And I was right in the middle of them. And it was a busy place. And what I wanted was to be told I was a great guy. And I wanted pats on the head. And I'd get that. That mightn't be unusual. Maybe all kids want it. But I really wanted it. And I could get it if I brought home good school reports and if I won things at sports. And from a very early age, before I'd gone near the booze, I was competing with my brothers and sisters, which caused lots of trouble afterwards, because it was me. Give me mine first. And it also set me up for the fact that that sort of alcoholism, the ism part, that other people were telling me if I felt good. Because if I won something, yeah, I was happy for a bit, but I was always afraid I wouldn't the next time. What was going to happen? There was a fear and a discomfort knocking around in myself. And when I was 13, I had my first drink and I went away. Peace and quiet. We all know that warm feeling, that fitting in feeling. It was just joy. There was a piece of me that was missing. There was an anxious piece of me and the booze filled it. I grew up in a Catholic family and it wasn't the punitive Catholicism. There was a bit of that, but my parents practiced the way of living that I think is a healthy way to live today. I went to a Catholic school and I threw it all out the window because they were telling me to do things. They were telling me to do things I wasn't going to do. So from there on in, I was reading books and philosophies and various things. I knew there was something wrong with me. I knew there was a bit missing with me. And I thought that if I read the right book or came across the right philosophy, I'd fix it. That it'd fill it in for me. It wasn't until I got to you people that I learned I wasn't doing the stuff. You know, I was reading the books, but there was no behavioral stuff. And that was a big piece that I got when I came to AA. And I'm not going to go through all my drinking, but it was, you can all identify, I just felt good. The drinking in Ireland with the pubs, it wasn't all bad at all. There was a real sense of belonging. There was the booze did it for me on its own, and it was for the effect from the beginning. I liked the taste of it, but it was the way it made me feel. And the pubs, the sort of football ladsy gang were all together, feeling warm, feeling identifying. No longer alone was out there for me. I got into trouble from an early age with it. I'd black out. It didn't bother me. I thought that was just life. I went picking grapes in France and met a lady who's my wife today, and she's here with me, thank God, because it's not thanks to me. And I was there because they gave you free booze. You know, that was the way my life was lived, and you could have a bit of fun afterwards if I had mine first. I went off to med school and I became a doctor. I'm a family doctor in a small town about an hour and a half from here. And I did that because I wanted to become a psychiatrist. And I wanted to become a psychiatrist because I wanted to fix myself. I knew I was a bit nutsy, and I reckon it got social prestige. The parents were happy. The community was happy. You got the pats on the back. So the rugby playing alcoholic doctor fitted in nice. It was part of the lifestyle. But something was dying in me. And I did go off and I studied psychiatry for a while. And all the books and the rest I read did nothing to cure my alcoholism. And I did, from 21 on, I'd said I'm an alcoholic and I was going to control my drinking. You know, cure it, drinking while drinking. And I did all those stuff in the big book, and I only drank beer and I only drank wine and I only drank on weekends. And I wouldn't be standing here today if it worked. And take you up to what happened at the end. As we moved a few times. We came to Canada with three young kids, and it was one day we were driving on a Sunday. And my daughter, the kids were 8, 6, and 4, a daughter and two boys. She turned to her brothers and said, "Shh, shh, Daddy's sick again." You know, and she could see me in the car. I'd tighten right up, I'd be there. The wife wouldn't let me drive. I asked her to stop the car and let me out, and I would say she would have been happy to run over me if she thought she could have gotten away with it. She let me out. But the difference then was I went and phoned. I phoned and I said, "I need help." You know, and 3 days later, I was in a treatment center down in Guelph, not far from here. And the guy told me his story. That was the first time. It was me, me, me until then. You know, me looking at me, centered on me, poor shagging me, why can't I fix me? And he told me his story. And he's a famous kind of guy in Ontario circles. But if you heard his story, it's outrageous. And I was listening to him. I said, "You did what?" And he shifted it for me. And what he said is, "Brendan," he said, "this is a spiritual program." He said, "If you're not prepared to look at the spiritual aspect of it, you can shag off, because we need the beds." I was prepared to look at anything. It was jump and jump how high. And he gave me the big book, and I found there what I'd been looking for all my life. I've been looking for all through my drinking days, and I've been looking for it beforehand, and I've been looking for it when I was studying psychiatry. And it told me straight away. And I just knew it was honest, and I knew I could identify with Bill's story straight off. He was saying, you have to do this stuff. And the people in the treatment center were saying the same thing. Especially, go to bed at 10 o'clock, lights out, get up in the morning, eat 3 meals a day. I was used to telling other people to do this, but I didn't do it. And I hear talk like terminal uniqueness, you know. It applies to the others, but not to me, thanks very much. I'm going to do it my way. But I got into the big book, and while I was lying there, within a week or so in the treatment center, the thought came to me, a real heavy thinker, that I hadn't made the world. You know, that it was there before me, and that it was going to be here after me, and that I was here for a short space of time. And that for me was my spiritual awakening. And I'd read all the stuff before, but I couldn't hear it. It couldn't get into me. Because right from that was, what am I meant to do while I'm here? You know, what the hell am I here for? And from that, I could start at least working on my spiritual program, my AA program. And I was piddling around with step three, and I was at a conference here in Toronto, and I heard Father Peter talk, and he said, all you're asked to do is make a decision. He says, you cannot turn your will and your life over to the care of your higher power, whoever he or she may be in step three. He says, if you could do that, you wouldn't need any of the other steps. He says, all you've been asked to do is make an honest decision to do it. And that hit me again. Because I knew he was telling me the truth. It was honest for me. And I stopped piddling around, and I got into looking at the stuff I'd done in the past. And I found that with my brothers and sisters at home, and with people growing up, and with my wife, and when I moved over here, I did the same thing. You know? You could change who the people were, but the same thing was me first. Selfishness. Ego, self-will run riot. You could have a bit afterwards if you wanted to, but I wanted mine first. And you know, but people often talk about that stuff getting them down. It didn't get me down. I was an alcoholic, but I wasn't stupid. I could see I was going through these steps to change the way. It was a program of change. I'd been told about that, that I didn't have to keep on doing that stuff. And I went and shared it with a buddy who's a priest near where I live, and it was a good feeling, you know. And it started that sort of breaking down the walls between you and me. Because beforehand, I tell you, whatever lies I thought was the best thing to make you think the best of me. you know, people pleasing, lying, cheating. And then I got into going, well, I had to do this entirely ready bit. How the hell do I become entirely ready in step six? And it was told to me, you know, I could take what little willpower I had and I could ask my higher power to help me, and I could do the opposite to the things I've been doing before. And I'm going to tie that in with a vision for you, because the vision for me is totally contingent upon how well I practice those steps. You know, and I'm not taking anybody's inventory here at all, but I am saying what I've heard from you people in AA is that we need our bottom to get into AA. We don't come here willingly. Who cares to admit complete defeat? Not shagging me, that's for sure. But I've no other choices left. And it was humiliating at the beginning. And then I had read and seen those promises. You know, those promises that are waiting there if we are painstaking. If we're painstaking about our recovery, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. I didn't need a vision. Bill Wilson told me what the vision was, loud and clear. I would not regret the past. You know, I've come to know peace. But it's not a given. It's only there contingent upon how well I work my program. And guess what? Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. But that's okay now, because I feel I've been given back the map. You know, beforehand, I was wandering around saying, how the hell do I get by on this planet? How do I live? What am I here for? I read the books, did all the different philosophies in them, but I wasn't doing them. So I got this gap. They talk about being an active alcoholic, you have to build these little warps into your thinking. You know, those mental twists. Well, I sure as hell had a lot of mental twists to blame other people for what my problems were. And in recovery, it's the recognition of those, not to be ashamed by them, but to recognize them and work on changing them. And change, change, change. That's what this program's all about for me. And I can't change unless I've identified what my problems are. And identifying it's fine, but then I have to work on them. There's a chap here who says, you take a horse thief and you sober him up, you still got a sober horse thief. You've got to work on that stuff. And I do. You know, I've got a program, and it starts every morning. I do my meditation. And I take a little time at lunchtime. I take a bit of time when I come home from work, and I take a few minutes before I go to bed. It doesn't take a lot of time. Just a few minutes to check in. And you know what? I'm always a little bit off balance. There's always something there. Say, I can have it right in the morning until I get out of bed. Or until one of the kids says something, or I get into it with my wife or something. But I use those four times to help keep me balanced. I got a sponsor whom I dearly love. He's the salt of the earth, and he's just rock solid. There's no bull attached to him, and I check in with him at least twice a week. The real secret, as you people in this program have told me, is, of course, in the moment. You know, if I find myself getting mad, if I find myself getting angry, to stop there and then ask for some guidance from my higher power. And if I ask, I'll get it. And for this alcoholic, like many I've heard before, the biggest problems are at home. You know, it's relationships that alcoholics have difficulty with. And one of the biggest rewards and blessings is, I mean, I have my wife here with me today. That's only thanks to this program. And a real blessing. You know, I don't deserve it. I know I don't deserve it. It's a gift from God. My kids, I got decent relationships with them. Sometimes I say the reason I keep going to AA is so that they'll be still around for my kids when they decide they need it. And time will tell whether that's there. But as regards the paternal end of it, you know, I can sleep at night. I used to wake up, wah, the jumps, you know. Something awful's going to happen. Something awful was going to happen. We talked about the jumping off place. I was coming to that. And I do make the point, someone would see me outside. And I've got a lovely wife, three nice kids, a good job, nice house. You know, the week before I came into recovery, one of my neighbors said, you have a maid. So I've no trouble identifying with the man in the glass. You know, inside job, in me. And the people pleasing for years beforehand, I hope I help somebody here, but if I don't take it personal. It helps me. It helps me because it helps keep me honest and it helps keep me straight. I don't like speaking, but that's what I've been told to do. Tough. Doesn't matter whether you like it or not. You do it because that's the way it is from here on in. And that's okay with me too, because I know if I just do the things that I like doing, that's right back to my drinking days. And I would mention when I came across booze, that was my drug of choice. I didn't need other ones. But during my one of my attempts to get sober, I stopped for about a month. And being a doctor, I had this office full of pills. So, woohoo, I convinced myself I had an anxiety condition. I sure as hell didn't feel well. I felt very jumpy and anxious. So after the month off the booze, there I was with the Valiums, the Lorazepams, the Xanaxes that I'm sure lots of you know or have heard of. So dual addiction's no problem for me. And street drugs were in there as well beforehand. I smoked my share of pot. I didn't need it because I had the booze most of the time. But I've no trouble identifying with people who have cross addictions. And I know I've got an addictive personality. I mean, that's part of what I learn in the recovery. I'm a marathon runner too, and I can identify with the diarrhea, and I can tell you as well, it hasn't gone away from me since I stopped the booze. Maybe there's something now. I'll go see your doctor. But able to stand here and laugh about those things now, joys of recovery, you know, and the biggest joy, you know, the biggest one, a vision for you, because I think we all have our own stories. Is that it gets better. Wow, that's what it is. Is that the thing we share together is we've been given this program and we've been given the map. And for me, keep an open mind, it isn't that we're alcoholic and there's the rest of the world out there. I think we're alcoholic and we've got a problem. We've got a disease and a sickness. And these guys came along with the program and gave us a treatment for it. And it fits me to resume my position in the outside world. And that's a gift. And I have friends who are priests and ministers, and they tell me they have difficulty getting the members of their congregation to get enthused about things. But the gift that's given in this program for me with the 12 steps is it is a chance to live again. And like Bill talks about the guys who were on the Titanic and got away with the lifeboats, you know I came so close to death. Not only my own death, but the death of people around me. They say it's a family disease. We kill our wives, we kill our kids. If we don't physically do it, we just drag the life out of them. We kill people drunk driving on the streets. Now, I've been given back this life, you know, and with that an enthusiasm. And do I mind speaking if somebody asks me? I don't mind at all. For a gift like that, you know. Bill talks at the end of that chapter, he talks about, if I can remember it, trudge the road to happy destiny. And I read that and I think, that's a mixed metaphor. You know, happy destiny is a joyous thing. Trudge it sounds like trudgery. You're pulling yourself along. That's the way it is for me. I've known all my life the things that are worthwhile don't come easy. I have to work on them. And I got to work on my program. And it's fair and it's honest with me. If I do the work, the happy destiny comes along there. If I'm trying to take the shortcuts, if I'm cheating and lying, and that isn't just with you, that's to me. And I got those little twists in there so I can do it. I need people to keep me honest. But if I'm checking in with them, keeping honest and working on it, the sky is the limit. I don't know what'll happen. I know bad things happen in life. Big deal. I used to milk that for all it was worth when I was a practicing alcoholic. Now I can take my place in the world and know a hell of a lot of good things happen in life. Happy, joyous, and free. If I bring myself along for the game, it's heads up and I'm there. I don't know what the future will hold, but I know it's optimistic. And that's thanks to you people. And just a couple of the things to touch on to finish. Brothers and sisters that I used to really have troubles with because they didn't like me. And they didn't like me because they knew me, because they lived with me. Gifts of sobriety, I'm godfather to their kids. You know, they come to me and ask me to be godfather. And I come from the sort of family that that remembers birthdays and that kind of things. They phone up and send cards. That doesn't come easy to me. But they're helping me, you know. I send them late to the kids. And they say, oh, that's okay. We know you're always late with it. But I do it, you know. And that being able to rejoin the world out there, it's just a joy. And that's what I wish for you. And I don't have to wish it because it's a given. Regardless of what happens in our lives, if we work the steps and develop the spiritual aspect, it gets better. I don't know what it's going to bring, but it gets better. And that's a gift. I don't know any other place that I can go and get that in this life. And when I come to a conference like this, you know, I saw all the people outside, and it was wrecking my head, to tell you the truth. It's just, I can't handle it. I'm living in a small town now. It's too big for me. But when I talk to you people and talk to you individually and see you, that sense of belonging, you know, no longer alone. And you know what? I know it's only going to get better as the weekend goes on. So I thank you. I thank you all for the gift of sobriety, and may your sobriety dates never change. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Brendan. Now, the floor is now open for members of the audience that wish to share. If you wish to share this topic, please line up at the microphones. There's two here. We ask that you please limit your comments to around 3 minutes. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Paul, an alcoholic member of the Walsingham group. Walsingham's a small country town or village west of here, about 2 hours, in Tobacco Country, near Lake Erie. I really, first of all, want to thank Brian and Brendan. It really meant a great deal to me to hear you today. And it's kind of a miracle how it works, because I was walking by. I was going to go to my sister's and have a rest, and I came up here. Thank God I did. I've been a member for since March 22, 2004, so I'm a newcomer. I could identify with a great deal you said. I started drinking and drank probably for 40 years. When I was a young man, my father had a talk with me after I had gotten out of jail, and suggested to me that there were some people that couldn't drink, and perhaps I was one, that my two grandfathers had been that way. My one grandfather was dead when he was very young. And I said, no, Dad, I'm not like that. I can drink more than any of my friends. And anyway, unfortunately, I didn't get the meaning. I didn't know about AA. But I did get a little smarter in terms. I realized I got in trouble when I went to bars, so I didn't drink in bars, and I confined my drinking to weekends. And I'm married a beautiful lady 30 years ago, and I have 6 children. It meant a great deal to hear you today, because I'm going to be 56 shortly, and sometimes it is a little discouraging that it took me so long to get in. About 15 months ago, my wife, things were pretty tense at home, and I told my wife, she was crying on a Saturday, and I thought she was having a nervous breakdown, and I thought, well, if it'd make her feel better, I'll stop drinking. Well, the next day I bought a case of beer, and the next night I went out to a bar. But on a Tuesday night after work, I went for a walk, and I knew things were very bad, and I just prayed, started praying as I walked, that God would help me somehow to stop. I used to pray all the time about 2 a.m. when I'd wake up and wonder why I drank again. But I really didn't. I just said, oh, God, you know, so I didn't really pray. But this time I meant it, and I realized there was church going on. I raced over to the church, and I'm also a member of the CIA, Catholic Irish Alcoholic. And I sat there. There were only a few of us in the church, and during the Mass, I just prayed, God, help me stop drinking. Help me be a better father and a better husband. The Mass is over, and a priest looked down. There were only about 10 people in church, and I was in one corner. He looked right at me, and he said, we're going to have confession after Mass for anybody that wants to go. So I went in, and I to confession, because he seemed to be looking straight at me. And I said, well, Father, I could keep you here all night, but I won't. I'll just tell you the main thing. I said, I felt dead spiritually for 10 years, and I said, I drink too much beer. And he said, well, you know, there's help. And I said, oh. And he said, yes, there's AA. Have you ever heard of AA? And I said, well, I've heard of it. He said, well, I think you should go. And I said, well, I'll go home and think about it. And he said, no, I think you should go to AA. And I said, well, I'll think about it. No, he said, you better go downstairs tonight. There's a meeting tonight. And I said, I don't think so. And he said, well, you realize every time you reach for that bottle that you're choosing that bottle over God and over your family. When he said that, it kind of hit home. And he said, so I think you better go downstairs. Well, I still wouldn't have gone, but about 18 years before that, a priest baptized my youngest son, and his name was Father Peter, Father Peter W., and he's a member of our program, and he had shared his story, and I thought, well, Father Peter went there, I guess maybe I could. But I went downstairs, and I thought it'd be one meeting. You know, you'd go to one, and I didn't know anything about it, and I got down there, and they read that first step, and I was sitting at the front, and I started to get nervous as all the people came in. And I thought, and they read the first thing, powerless over alcohol and lives unmanageable. And even though I'd been drinking for 40 years and promised my wife for 2.5 that I'd stop, I thought, well, I'm not powerless over alcohol. And my life's not unmanageable. I got a job and I got a house and I got a family. And they read the second step, return to sanity. And I thought, well, I'm perfectly sane. Anyway, thank God they got to tradition 3 because I was ready to leave. When they hit tradition 3 and a desire to stop drinking, I thought, well, I'm going to stay. And I stayed that night, and they were a really tremendous group. And one fella said that when he looked back in his life, all the regrets he had one common element, and that was he was always under the influence of drugs or alcohol. When he said that, it really hit me, and I stayed. And when I was leaving that night, an older fella said, looked right at me and called my name, Paul, and I turned and he said, and he had this real compassionate look, and he said, Paul, don't drink. Come to meetings. And someone invited me to a meeting, and I did that. And over the months, I learned how sick I had been, and it seemed to peel away with layers, it's changed my life. I still have a little tension. A month ago, my wife got a little upset with me, and she said, well, you know, I waited for you to study and work, and then I waited while you coached for 25 years, and then you joined AA, and I still never see you. You're gone 7 days a week. But anyway, she wished me well and sent me down here. But it meant a great deal to hear you two gentlemen talk tonight or today, and I just want to thank you and wish you well and wish everybody another 24. Bye.
Jeff Graco, recovering alcoholic from Pennsylvania, United States. I was thinking the United States were celebrating the 4th of July and getting away from Great Britain, and you know, when you said, you used the word shag, we used the word F-U, something, you know. And I just think shag is such a wonderful thing. And I'm picturing you guys up there. I'm basically standing up here to share about the chapter of Vision for You. A promise was made to me, and he told me about the vision. And I'm not real proud to be standing up here and sharing my past experience. I've been sober almost 18 years, and about 16 years I said, you know, shag it. You know, I don't. This isn't working for me. I had enough courage to reach out to another alcoholic, and I was supposed to meet a friend here earlier for the spiritual awakening meeting. He wasn't here. But I got to hear what I needed to hear about the spiritual awakening. The vision. What has happened? I've been blessed by finding a big book group, a big book step study group, and the big book has been such a wonderful reward for me. I thought just going to meetings and being in fellowship was going to be good enough for me. And it almost took me out. And I'm so grateful that at the end of every meeting that we have, we read a vision for you. And it says in there, may God bless you and keep you till then. You know, that when we're walking along that and trudging that road to happy destiny, it reminds me of the pamphlet, A Solution for You, where I don't know if it's a man or a woman in a pool of mud or something, and everybody's there pulling the person out. And I need to maintain my link in that chain, you know, or everybody else is falling in with me. And, the whole time I'm thinking of the movie Braveheart, you know, I just love the British accents and the Scotland and Wales. And, I could picture the three of us. He knows exactly what I'm going to say. You know, with our bare asses lifting our kilts up saying, screw you, you know. And that's what I got to thinking about, you know. My country basically said to you guys, screw you, we're going somewhere else and start our own thing. And it's funny that as an American, I'm here with some people from Great Britain, the very people we said F you to. And all these other countries in the world, we're not feuding and fighting. We're helping each other. And I also want to say, if anybody wants to drink today, please, please, please talk to somebody about it. And if this is your last meeting, talk to somebody about it. Because I go to meetings now, and I love every single one of them. I guess the reason I got up here is I got a chance to meet you and your wife before the meeting, and you had the courage to leave your homelands and go somewhere else. And I've always been afraid to go on those vision quests and those journeys. You know, I have to make, you know, with my spirituality and everything else, I've been a skeptical inquirer. I can't even say that I'm an agnostic or an atheist. I'm a skeptical inquirer. It has to be proven to me. And, you know, it says it in the spiritual experience, the appendix in the big book, about Herbert Spencer makes a comment about contempt prior to investigation, you know, and my contempt and my self-centeredness and my pride is just, you know, it was destroying all that. And I'm just so glad that I'm open to hear your ideas and your thoughts, and I'm able to listen and process it and share that with other human beings. This is a funny, I know I'm over my three limits, but my sponsor actually stole my car, and he went out and used, and so that was very traumatic for me. And my home group stepped up, and they said, oh, how are you doing? Are you okay? And I said, yes, you know, surprisingly I am. These steps got me through it. I was like, what are you asking me if I'm all right for? I'm fine. I was able to deal with that situation. You know, that's the first time I've had a tragic situation in 10 years, you know, where something was taken from me financially like that. And I just was wonderful to be able to get through that. And it's been by the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to get through that situation. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. We've only got time for one more people. I don't like it to stop anybody from sharing, believe me, but we've got to have this wrapped up by 5:45, and this gentleman has been here the longest, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chava. I'm from Johannesburg, South Africa. I enjoyed the sharing from both speakers. I'm here, you know, through the grace of God. I know I flew British Airways, but it's through me. The blessing that God has given me. When I grew up, I knew I had political problems with God. You know, from Johannesburg, where we are from. I just didn't understand the situation that we're in, but I came into AA, I found that politics don't mean anything to me anymore. And the vision that I found in AA is adequate and more than adequate for me. You people taught me that the road to recovery is always under construction. My sobriety and happiness, like you said, is contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And that this program is not a theory. It's a doable program. And for that I'm most grateful. Because I come from a very religious family, but I rebelled, like most of our colleagues we do. And then God gave me AA, and AA gave me back my God. The God that I understand, the God that loves me, not a punishing God. And for that I'm most grateful. And the vision for me is freedom from the bondage of self. Freedom from that sense of impending doom when I was still drinking. The fears, the resentment and everything. And those four horsemen. For that I'm most grateful. Thank you very much.
I think that's what it's all about. I'd like to thank Brian and Brendan for being our speakers tonight and coming. Ruth for reading the 12 steps and pointing out to me that my own group is in Ontario. And Kathy for reading the 12 traditions. And especially you guys. You know, if it wasn't for you guys, none of us would be here. So thank you for participating tonight. For those who would, if you would help me close with a responsibility declaration. I am responsible when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to always be there, and for that I am responsible.